You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 12th of March 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24 live from Studio One in London with me, Andrew Tuck. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, Sudan and South Sudan have agreed to resume the flow of oil between the two nations. We'll have the latest. We'll also head to Serbia, where Guy Delorni reports on the efforts of the nation's youth to take the economy into their own hands.
Now, in the moment in Serbia, there is no a lot of job for us, so we could sit home waiting to something to happen, but we decided to make something good for us, and we succeed, I think.
Plus, our news editor Tom Edwards is channeling Hemingway in today's monologue, and he's hoping you've noticed the fine-looking notebook he's scribbled it in.
Writing in a notebook with pen or pencil seems to imbue the very words or pictures with that bit more emotion. Want to know what someone is thinking? Then look at what they are writing.
All that. Plus, we'll check in with Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulet, who's in Frankfurt, and find out why they've written a play about Roger Federer. All that to come in the next hour here on Midori House. But first, let's catch up on the headlines with Jonathan Wheatley.
The doors of the Sistine Chapel have now been shut, leaving the 115 Roman Catholic cardinals inside to start a conclave to elect the next pope. The first the world will know a new pope has been chosen is when white smoke appears from a chimney on the chapel's roof. A two-thirds majority is needed to elect the new pope. The first outcome is likely to be inconclusive because there's no outright front-runner to succeed Benedict. According to Rory Scott from bookmakers Paddy Power, Italy's Angelo Scola and Brazil's Odilo Scherer are possible candidates.
Down here in the Vatican Square, the atmosphere is electric. The excitement is palpable, and it's the same in the betting. We're taking bets all over the place. A lot of money is flooding in at the moment. Obviously, for the Pope, the current favourite is Cardinal Archbishop Scola of Italy, and he's followed by Cardinal Scherer of Brazil, and he's come in the betting quite a lot recently. We've seen a lot of money for him.
A New York City police officer has been convicted today of plotting to kidnap, cook and eat women following a trial that shed light on an underworld of people who derive pleasure from fantasizing about cannibalism online. A federal court jury also found Gilberto Valle, aged 28, guilty on a lesser charge of improperly accessing a law enforcement database to gather personal information about potential targets. Five US military personnel have been killed in a helicopter crash in southern Afghanistan. The NATO-led International Security Assistance Force in Afghanistan, or ISAF, said the crash occurred yesterday, Monday. Brigadier General Gunter Katz is the spokesman for ISAF.
It's with deep regret that I have to inform you that yesterday five ISAF soldiers died following a helicopter crash in southern Afghanistan. The investigation is ongoing. However, early reporting indicates that the crash is not related to any enemy activity.
A report presented to the Human Rights Commission by UN Special Rapporteur Marzuki Darusman has identified nine types of human rights violations in North Korea, including a camp system thought to hold up to 200,000 prisoners.
These are camps that have the purpose of driving the people being detained there towards a slow death. It's clear that the national priorities are not to meet the requirements of the population, but to boost its military capability. Of the three national priorities of North Korea, and this is official, the first priority is military, the second one is military, and the third is also military.
Members of the Falkland Islands Legislative Assembly had strong words for Argentine President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner today, following a two-day election in which the islanders almost unanimously voted to stay under British rule. The official count showed 99.8% of islanders voted in favour of remaining a British overseas territory, with only three no votes out of 1,672 votes cast. The referendum was rejected by Buenos Aires as a meaningless publicity stunt. Gavin Short is one of the Falkland Islands Assembly's 8 elected members.
President Fernandez de Kirchner, we have sent you a message. We have absolutely no desire to be ruled by the government in Buenos Aires. I hope that you now might respect that. Now is also the time that the rest of the world starts to listen to the voice of the Falkland Islanders rather than the empty lies, endless rhetoric and political posturing.
And finally, some 26,000 diamonds worth at least $162,000 and contained in transparent plastic bags in hand luggage proved too much for the nothing to declare lane at a Moscow airport. An unemployed 37-year-old Russian man carrying the precious package from Dubai was detained at the international Sheremetyevo airport. One customs officer noted that the man was very nervous during regular luggage checks. And that's the latest news here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. It's 18:06 here in London, and you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Buenos Aires
to Hong Kong
to Berlin,
to Tel Aviv,
to Toronto,
to Amsterdam,
to Zurich.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
In an agreement that perhaps underlines the enduring interdependence of the two nations, Sudan and South Sudan will resume the flow of oil from the south to the north in the next 2 weeks, overturning the year-long drought enforced by the government in Juba. Such an agreement must be welcomed by both sides. An estimated 75% of all the former United Sudan's oil reserves are in South Sudan, while the refineries and pipeline to the Red Sea are in their northern neighbour. In a process that will reflect many of the teething issues of South Sudan's secession from the north in 2011, the first step will see the withdrawal of troops by both sides from a demilitarised zone along the border. This will ease tensions, hopefully, and open the way to resuming the oil exports. But how will this work out, of course, remains to be seen. Well, joining us on the line to explore just how important this decision is and what the oil will mean for both nations is Dana Wilkins of Global Witness. Dana, thank you very much for joining us. The first thing to say is that this isn't exactly a new agreement, is it? It's one that's been brokered many times before and breached many times before. What hope is there of it sticking this time?
There's a lot of optimism around this particular deal, although, you know, of course, there's always optimism around when things start to look to get settled between Sudan and South Sudan. It's really important that you remember that actually the negotiations on an oil deal period began back in October 2010. South Sudan became independent, establishing autonomy over its own oil sector back in July of 2011, and it wasn't until September of last year that they actually agreed to the terms under which South Sudan would be exporting its oil via Sudan. So it's been a very long time coming. There's reason to be hopeful. There's a lot of pressure on both sides for this deal to actually be implemented properly, both from, you know, aid donors, international partners, and the oil companies themselves that have stakes in the blocks.
And do you think that's the kind of the breakthrough, really, that it is, you know, the Chinese, the Malaysian, the Indian backers of these oil companies who have said to both sides, look, you need to get a deal in place or otherwise we're not going to continue our investment?
I mean, it's certainly part of it, part of the ongoing pressure. But, you know, what it comes down to is that oil wasn't really the deciding factor here. It was the security arrangements that had to be sorted out. It's, you know, real troop withdrawal from the demilitarized border zone and started, you know, movement on agreements on some of the disputed areas.
Now, with the export of oil choked off for so long, how damaging has this been for the government, especially in Juba in the south?
I mean, hugely damaging. Very suddenly, they lost more than 98% of their annual budget, right? So they've been operating on an austerity budget, to say the least, one that, you know, we would find it really difficult to understand, considering it's a brand new government. They're really starting to invest in building up major infrastructure projects and all of that, and all of a sudden it was shut down. One of the bright sides to that, one of the silver linings, is that they have had a chance to start really making moves on developing alternative sectors, so the agriculture sector. There's been a lot of talk about the nascent mining sector. So, silver linings to everything, as hard as it's been.
Now, we use the word interdependence in the introduction to that story. And does it kind of hint that, in fact, neither of these countries work very successfully as independent countries without the other one backing them?
Well, backing is probably an interesting word to use. I think, their relationship's always been extremely tense, and it always will be just because of their history. But you're right to point out that, at least for now, with the oil sector, which for both of them is the single most important, they will rely on each other, because Sudan was going to be reliant on those transit fees from South Sudan. And at the moment, Sudan is South Sudan's only export transit route. So that they've talked about alternative pipelines via Kenya and also via Ethiopia and Djibouti. Those alternative pipelines are a very long way away and a very large amount of money.
Now, you hinted there that this isn't a kind of a single issue story in a way, that there are many other things wrapped around this. What do you think are the other things that need to fall in place for there to be kind of good relations between the two countries and actually for the South Sudan to kind of really thrive as an independent country?
There's so much mistrust between the two of them, and that's both problematic in their relationship with each other and also domestically, because this mistrust and this idea of each other as a boogeyman really fuels domestic instability and fuels a lot of, all of a sudden opacity in areas where they might otherwise be transparent and more open to progress. And you can see this in sort of the crackdowns on the media in South Sudan, for example. And all of a sudden, the South Sudanese government is starting to look a lot like the government in Khartoum, just as things get more tense and the situation feels more desperate, the economic situation, I mean.
Well, Dana, thank you very much for joining us. That's Dana Wilkins of Global Witness, and thank you for joining us today. Now, coming up next, we're going to ask why the Bavarian city of Erlangen has become the patent capital of Europe.
Each week on The Curator, one of our Monocle editors rounds up the very best of the week just gone on Monocle 24.
You can be European, meaning reliable, responsible, you believe in democracy and environmental protection and, equal justice. These are all Islamic values too.
From hard-hitting political interviews to live music sessions, from food and film to retail and travel, we'll handpick the best of the week's shows for an hour of essential listening.
It's not like New York, because New York, it's like you can walk to Central Park, you can walk anywhere you want. There's an urban continuity. In here, you have to get into a car or get into something that moves and get out of here.
That's The Curator, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time on Monocle 24. Brought to you in association with Rolex.
Change is in the air in Madrid, so Monocle Films headed to Spain to witness how small businesses are reassessing archaic practices in order to weather the storm.
We're selling a lot, and that's great. And that's because we have created a special experience of buying. We're very proud of being Spaniards, and that's something that we want to show off, because we think that there is a lot of people doing very interesting.
Madrid Remake, creatively minded Spaniards taking their fate into their own hands. Now playing on Monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. Nowhere, it seems, in Europe are inventors as active as in the German city of Erlangen. The city holds the record for the record number of patents filed each year. Highlights include inventions such as digital training methods for football players and endoscopes with 3D cameras. This burgeoning creativity is supported by an active collaboration between the university and industry in Erlangen, a union that has arguably led to economic stability and a favourably low unemployment rate of just 2.9%. Sounds pretty good, no? Well, Matthias Lochmann, professor of the Institute of Sports and Science at the Friedrich Alexander University in Erlangen, spoke to Tom Edwards to explain exactly how the city and the university has done it.
The most important reason is the localization of very big companies. So at first, Siemens. Siemens has its healthcare development center here in Erlangen, and it is historically well connected to the Friedrich Alexander University of Erlangen. And this is one big driver. I think the other big driver is the Adidas company. It is 10 kilometers away. And in the vision of Adidas company, they announced that they would like to intensify the connection to the Friedrich Alexander University. And furthermore, we have an unemployment rate here in Erlangen of 2.9. This is full employment. And therefore, I think this is some... Now you have some reasons why it is very interestingly, or why cool people or smart people will be work in Erlangen and or work in Erlangen, and so the density of people with academic background is also, I think, very high here in Erlangen, and this is a small city, Erlangen, but nevertheless we have so much power in medical techniques and sports performance research, and I think this is one reason, or these are several reasons.
It's really fascinating, Matthias, and it's interesting that one of the things you look at, obviously, is how these kind of technologies can help within sports, and that's obviously quite interesting because I guess traditionally sport is maybe not always an area that one would associate with the latest cutting edge in science. Is it quite easy, do you think, to persuade people of the merits of science? Can you really show them the kind of benefits that they can enjoy, even if it's a football team, for example?
I think we will soon see a paradigm shift in training sciences, because now technology is cheap available. So some years ago you had to pay a lot of money to have computer power. Now it is very cheap, and the new thing is that you will have a microstructure of computer techniques, and you can implement it maybe in classes or something, or you have this smartphone as a wearable computer, and this leads to new approaches to do training, maybe in soccer, and we developed a new kind of training systems, digital training, so it is possible to use some kind of real-time feedback, computer-driven, with localization methods, and to apply these kind of training approaches in the moment of the training, and with a delay of 500 milliseconds maximum. And therefore, it's possible to use this real-time feedback to bring it to a paradigm shift in applied training sciences.
It's something that I think certainly a lot of the English football teams could maybe use at the moment. I just wanted to ask you, Matthias, about the process of patents, though, and protecting these ideas. We've mentioned then that it's such a centre. There are so many patent applications there, maybe the highest per capita in Europe. How important is it to protect these ideas and to protect these technologies by using patents?
Yes, this is the most important thing. So we have one example, the Fraunhofer Society in Germany. They have a lot of money, and their approach is to secure the ideas with patents. And this is the business model. And then use the money to pay new engineers and to give the engineers good positions and very well or very good labs to do more sciences. And for us, it is really very important to do that, to save these ideas. And so this is one of the most important things, I think. And so it's possible to use this kind of ideas, maybe in sports, to give licenses with new training approaches, maybe to a nation or a soccer club. And then they can have some steps before by using these training methods for maybe 3 to 5 years. And maybe this will lead to new championships. So this is my vision, yeah.
Well, that was Matthias Lockmann, professor of the Institute of Sports and Science at the Friedrich Alexander University in Erlangen, speaking with Tom Edwards. Mm. Now, we're going to be heading to Greenland shortly, and to warm us up, if that's the correct word, we have a song. Well, the band is called Nanook. That isn't too bad. Now, brace yourselves. Get a herring out. Pause. And this is the name of the song. It's called Ingala in Alakwakut. Well, I'm not going to murder that again. I'm told that it roughly translates as "We're still going strong," and it's by Nanook. And there's a whole kind of guttural thing going on there. Maybe our next guest will be able to help us out, because today a national parliamentary election is taking place in Greenland, and voters in the Chile capital Nuuk are streaming into the town's only polling station to cast their votes in an election where mining, Chinese influence, and the environment are key issues. To tell us more about all of these issues and the candidates is Paul Krarup, editor-in-chief of the newspaper Sermitsiach. So hopefully you'll be able to tell us what's going on today in Nuuk. What are the key issues for electors?
The key issue is the mineral resources, how we can develop the resources and how we can use them.
And tell me, I understand there is some kind of concern between the different candidates about outside influence, you know, whether you should be bringing in Chinese workers to try and help you exploit these resources. Is that a contentious issue in this election?
Yes, of course. The most important thing for Greenland is that we, our own workers, get the jobs first, and our own companies will be used before the foreign companies are used. And that is going to be the negotiations between the governments and the big international companies.
Now, we know that Greenland has a small population for a country, some 57,000 people, but there is growing interest amongst some people within the country for greater autonomy from Denmark. You already have some independence. You're in a commonwealth. Is there a call within this election, do you think? Is there another step towards total independence?
Yes. in the future, of course, a small party which is talking about autonomy now, as soon as possible. But the big parties, they say it is in the future when we can afford it, when we are economically independent of Denmark. For the moment, we can't afford to be independent. Then our living conditions will be very bad.
And tell me, you know, that security-wise, obviously, Greenland is a vast country, and up in the north there's already, you know, a peaceful amount of jostling between the Russians, Canada, Denmark, Greenlanders. Again, would that be a contentious issue that, you know, militarily wise, if you were going to take another step towards independence, how do you maintain the security of your country?
Yes, that is one of the main issues. If we're going to be independent, we can't be alone. We have to have partners. Either we continue with Denmark as a partner, or we choose EU or United States, or how we can work it out. We have seen that Iceland, they do not have a military, and they manage to do that. But I'm not sure that the United States will allow that Greenland, which is a part of the Western Hemisphere, that the United States will allow that Greenland is not defended, I mean, without military. So,
and Paul, tell
it
me,
it must be in the situation when Greenland can get complete autonomy, then we have to look for a partner that can help us with our defense, with our foreign policy, with our currency, the money, etc. Because we know we are too small to be completely independent.
And Paul, tell me, how quickly will you know the result? Will that be known tomorrow, who's winning? And who is the likely victor, do you think?
I will guess that the government, the ruling parties will continue.
And they will continue on what will be their key pledges, do you think, to the people if they win?
They will continue policy to get industrialization and the using of them, our raw materials, as quickly as possible.
Brilliant.
And they will be stable. They will continue a stable policy. They will not change the conditions on which the foreign companies can work in Greenland. And they will be very keen to make these agreements with the companies who are interested to work in Greenland.
Paul, thank you very much. And before we quickly say goodbye, can you tell me, are Nanook big in Greenland?
Oh, yes.
We played them just before you came on. They're popular, are they, in Greenland?
They are very popular.
Good.
They're very popular.
Good. Well, we like them too. Well, thank you very much for joining us. That was Paul Krarup, who's the editor-in-chief of the newspaper Sermitsiach, and he was talking to us about the elections up there in Greenland. The votes will be coming in about 6 hours' time. Tune in to Monocle 24. I'm sure we'll be covering them live. But now it's time to cross over for the news with Jonathan Wheatley.
Andrew, thanks very much. In Rome, the doors of the Sistine Chapel have now been shut, leaving the 115 Roman Catholic cardinals inside to start a conclave to elect the next pope. The first the world will know a new pope has been chosen is when white smoke appears from a chimney on the chapel's roof. Members of the Falkland Islands Legislative Assembly had strong words for Argentine President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner today, following a two-day election in which the islanders almost unanimously voted to stay under British rule. The count showed 99.8% of islanders voting in favour of remaining a British overseas territory, with just three votes saying no out of 1,672. A report presented to the Human Rights Commission by UN Special Rapporteur Marzuki Darusman has identified nine types of human rights violations in North Korea, including a camp system thought to hold up to 200,000 prisoners. And a New York City police officer has been convicted today of plotting to kidnap, cook and eat women following a trial that shed light on an underworld of people who derive pleasure from fantasizing about cannibalism online. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck. Now, despite the apparent meltdown of Frankfurt's transport infrastructure, Tyler Brulé, who's our editor-in-chief, has braved the snow and has agreed to join us from the leading bathroom experience convention, ISH Frankfurt. Tyler, thank you for coming on. How bad is it, the weather there in Frankfurt?
Well, it's sort of calmed down now, and I have to say, Andrew, you don't have the sound of all of the children playing in the schoolyard behind me. I've left the Messe, of course, which is Frankfurt's massive trade fair center, and have scampered back to the hotel. But it was kind of crazy today.
No, but tell me about the ISH. I've been there once with you before. It's a vast exhibition center. Why are you there? What are the brands that you're looking at, and what are the stories you're trying to find there?
Well, ISH is the most important, and we should probably say that what it stands for, it's the International Sanitation and Heating Fair. So this is the most important convention on the international calendar. If you are a developer, a contractor, an architect, and of course you have to be fitting copper or steel pipes to get water for all of the functions that we need every day out the end of the tap or a shower head or even toilet for that matter. In terms of why we're here, this is, of course, we have a design issue coming up. May is our design issue. And everything to do with waterworks is a huge part of design. And I guess the big theme here is, how do we use less? And every single stand that you go to, there's an enormous amount of focus on giving people the same type of experience that we've been used to, high water pressure, etc., but consuming less at the same time.
But on the health issue around these stories, we had an interesting story on the radio some weeks ago, which was looking at Thailand, and it's kind of government ambition to get people sitting on kind of regular Western toilets. But there was some resistance there in the market because people felt they were less hygienic. Is hygiene still a kind of a key part of what you see on display?
Yes and no. I think that one of the main elements, without being too graphic, even on radio, is how you can have self-cleaning devices. So if we're talking about toilets, using new technologies, Toto, one of the big Japanese firms, has a system right now which uses light to help break down bacteria. So it is a big part of the story, and I can say that you don't see a lot of squat toilets on display. In fact, I walked around, I don't think I saw any today.
And tell me, on the kind of more shower side of things, it's interesting the materials that have come into play over the last few years. You know, we've seen a kind of a drift away from porcelain, and now it seems a kind of slight drift back again. Are people using, plastics? Are we seeing, new materials from the likes of DuPont for creating bathrooms? Or are we going back to kind of more classic, in these times of, serious economies and things? Are we going back to kind of more traditional materials?
Well, it's interesting. One of the major German companies, and it's a company which has won an award. I think many of us who go to a lot of hotels and you're able to see and experience new projects where of course, people are using new materials, they're using new fit-outs in hotels. We've seen the move to the plastic bathtub, for example, which I don't think is a very a very pleasurable experience. It just feels somewhat cheap, but of course there was a big move to using all types of resins, etc. Now there's more of a move, and one of these award-winning companies, they're using steel, but it's enamel-covered steel, like you would have had at the turn of the last century. So it is interesting to see there's a return to that, but now, of course, you have laser-cut technologies, etc., that can create much thinner profiles, much lighter weight versions of these basins, etc., which you wouldn't have had before.
Now, I know that when we kind of look at the expenses sheet at the end of the month, there's always seems to be quite a few Monocle journalists heading off to trade fairs in Germany. Why do you think the Germans have cornered this market and everything? We've been at the furniture fair recently. Last week was ITB in Berlin. Are the Germans just very good at putting on these events?
They are. And part of this was what happened in the post-war years, that there was a focus on Germany rebuilding itself and making its way in the world was to, of course, host the world. So whether it's Berlin, and this is interesting because Germany is well and truly a polycentric country. Frankfurt has invested incredibly in their Messe, but then so too is Munich. And then, of course, you've got Cologne and Düsseldorf. And coming up very soon, we'll be doing a big story in Hamburg about the aircraft interior show. So if you go to any German city of scale, somehow they've managed to corner 5 or 6 major international events that the world has to come to, on their calendar. Not to mention, the myriad small trade fairs that are domestic or also regionally focused as well. And everyone likes, a good pretzel when they're walking between trade stand exhibitions.
But it's strange when you look at a market like the UK, for example. And I was speaking to somebody today who was telling me that actually one of the biggest exhibition centres here in London, the Earl's Court Exhibition Centre, is to be demolished and not replaced. They're going to shove all the business from there over to Olympia, the other base here in London. That I guess, do you think it's also that the German cities are of a size and not as expansive as London, that you can actually have a good hotel near the Messe, the transport links are pretty good, people can come in for 2 days and disappear again? Because in Frankfurt hasn't got a reputation for being perhaps the most exciting city to hole up in, but is it just the efficiency also of these cities, the way that they run these events?
Yeah, of course, you have Frankfurt Airport, which is now a proper 4-runway airport. Nevertheless, no matter how many runways you have on a day like today, when it was snowing from 4 a.m. and was still snowing at about 4 or 5 o'clock this afternoon, snow can still close those runways down and grind to a halt. Nevertheless, you have this massive airport, which is on the doorstep of the trade fair. And it's interesting, as you say, because the UK does not host events of this international scale. I can't think of anything on either a biannual or annual calendar that comes anywhere close to the number of things that the Germans are holding.
And finally, Tyler, can you tell me, is there a good party to go to at the bathroom fair?
would you believe it if I said I'm almost ready to put my jammies on? There's of course a lot of private there's a lot of private events that are held, but no, I've not seen anything. No one has passed any flyers my way. I've not received any emails saying that I've been invited to the secret must go to party. One thing you do need to probably invest in. We could look at one from Midori House though. Big business in foot baths right now. So this is something that a number of companies are pushing as the new basin that you need to have in your house.
Okay, you heard it here first, and you'll be seeing them installed, no doubt. Midori House, I doubt it, actually. But anyway, if you get a ticket to a jacuzzi party, Tyler, go. It could be fun. Leave your pyjamas behind. And thank you very much for joining us. That was Tyler Brulé, who, of course, is Monocle's editor-in-chief. And I know that he's just arrived back from Asia. That hence the jammies. I think he deserves a bit of a sleep. Well, thank you for joining us, Tyler. And next on Midori House, we're going to be having a little bit of music. We're also going to be looking at what's happening in Serbia. So stay tuned.
If you're looking for great Monocle content on your smartphone or tablet device, download the Monocle app today. We'll bring you the daily Monocolumn Bulletin with fresh opinions from our editors, the essential 25/25 city guide to the best business cities and resorts, and the full Monocle 24 radio experience with our time shift player, so you can catch up on any shows you may have missed. Download our Monocle app today for your smartphone or tablet. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to Midori House, and it's 1840 here in London. It's not easy to be young in Europe over the past few years. The financial crisis has made it hard to find jobs or set up businesses, and it's particularly tough in Serbia. Officially, more than 4 out of 10 young people there are unemployed. But not all of them are waiting for someone else to give them a break. In Belgrade, a group of young people have found that an empty building and creative ideas can make for a brighter future. Our correspondent, Guy Delaunay, went to meet them.
I'm outside what looks like a fairly dilapidated building. Lots of interesting artistic graffiti on the walls, though. And as you walk inside, you can see the sign, Inex Film. This place actually used to be a part of a film production company. And now, as you squeeze through the door, you can see all sorts of different artworks, stencils, graffiti on the walls. And that indicates what's going on in here now. A group of young people, creative types, not just artists, but also interior designers, photographers, architects, have taken this place over. A lot of it is still pretty much derelict, but they have claimed a great big part of this for themselves, done it up so they can use it as a workspace and try and make something in Serbia, where it's very difficult for young people to get jobs of any kind. And this group of young people haven't waited for permission, they haven't waited for other people to help them out. They've taken this place for themselves and they're making something of it.
If you don't take that in your own hands, nobody will give you.
Maria is a 26-year-old artist and one of the founders of the Inex Film Collective.
Now, in the moment in Serbia, there is not a lot of job for us, so we could, sit home waiting to something to happen, to be better. But we decided to have a fun, to make something good for us. Maybe we try to do that and we succeed, I think.
What sort of inspiration do you think you're providing for young people who, they're in a country at the moment which has got
at best, a 30% unemployment rate, and that's probably worse for young people because it normally is worse for young people. So what sort of inspiration do you think you've been able to provide for them?
They started to realizing that you can do something with your own will. It's not the best solution, probably. It's not that you will become rich, but you will be satisfied with yourself. Every day we are bigger, we are growing. Our idea is spreading, and it's the most important. There is a lot of abandoned spaces in Belgrade, which can also be taken, like Inex Film was taken, and make something good from it.
This small art school is one of the good things which Maria has created, along with her partner, Steven. But more strikingly, the founders of Inex Film may be promoting a new way of thinking among young people in Serbia, a place where people have traditionally relied on the state to see them through troubled times. Mika is another of the organizers at the collective.
For us, it's really a success because it's a bottom-up initiative that is giving space for these people, you know. This squatting thing is past in Europe. It is seen before, but here in Belgrade, it's a new thing, and it didn't come like from a study visit to Amsterdam or something like that. It just came because these people really needed a space, so they just took it away.
Are there any positives you can take as a society from the fact that there is this very high unemployment rate, that the traditional jobs maybe that people might have gone into, whether it's offices, factories, any other kind of industries, on there? How can you turn that around, do you think?
I always remember the hard years, like sanctions or the bombardment or something like that. In those moments, you have a really high solidarity level between people. And if anything positive should happen from this, it should be solidarity. And for me, it is the, I don't know, guidance for my work.
The teenagers in the art school carry on as young people usually do, laughing, chatting, and perhaps picking up some ideas. Maria and Mika hope they're not just about art, but about adopting a less deferential, more proactive attitude to life. Judging by some of the students, like 18-year-old Nenad, they might be onto something.
Maria and Steven helped me a lot because they show me the path of non-mainstream thinking. So,
do you tell your friends about it?
Yeah, of course. I brag all the time.
What sort of reaction do you get from them?
Well, they're shocked pretty much at first, but they came here and they were all like really surprised how well we are organized here. So they really like it here.
So in at least one semi-derelict corner of Belgrade, there's hope for the future. The people at Inex Film aren't dreamers, they're realists. They know the best chance they've got is to make something happen for themselves. Maria says it's all about showing people how to make the best of a bad situation.
There is a lot of problem with young people who gave up. Okay, you're living in a wrong country, maybe, but you can change something. You cannot let yourself to lose your enthusiasm for living with 25 or 30. People became lazy, it's a fact here, but we are trying to fix that.
And that may not just be limited to Belgrade. People in other parts of Serbia have caught on to what the Inex Film project is doing, and they want to take spaces for themselves. The old state industries may have gone, and thousands of jobs with them, but something new is flowering among the wreckage. For Monocle in Belgrade, this is Guy Delaunay.
Now we're going to be heading over to Geneva shortly to find out about how you make a play about a tennis star. But first of all, we're going to Swiss things up a bit with All I Remember by Heidi Happy. She may not sound it, but that's Heidi Happy. and that's all I remember. Now, we're going to go over to Geneva because there's a play there about Roger Federer. With his clean-cut image, it's perhaps difficult to imagine a play being made about him, but In Love with Federer is produced by a small theatre company in Geneva, and it's honouring the style and the charisma of the national tennis hero, Roger Federer. The play has successfully toured Switzerland and is now embarking on another tour of France. Monocle's Phil Hahn spoke to the co-producer, Denis Maillefer, who shared his passion for the sporting hero and explained how the play came to be exciting.
The play is about two guys who love so much Roger Federer and decide to come on stage and to tell to the audience why they do like or love him so much. And it's more about Roger Federer, of course, but it's about the way of being totally lonely in his life, to have to deal every day with his body and to deal with the death which is coming. And it's a kind of step by step it changes, but it's basically quite funny because the two guys are a little bit stupid, not stupid, but they are too much really. And it's basically a true story with the other actor and me. And of course, we exaggerate our passion for Roger Federer.
So essentially, it sounds like what it is, a story of two obsessed fans with Roger Federer. Why would you think that would make an interesting plot line?
Because I think everybody likes or loves something or somebody like in a crazy way like this. It could be somebody of his family or it could be Madonna in a way. But I think what is interesting is the way we tell about all this. And basically, it's about us, the two actors, and we hope that then it's about everybody which is in the audience, because it's like an autobiography of us on stage and speaking about Federer.
Did you have the chance ever to meet Roger Federer?
But unfortunately not, but in a way it's very sad, but we hope we are going to. But in another way, it's nice because the show is about the way to think about something like a fantasy, or like you think so much about this and you never meet him and it never happens. So you can dream with the idea of who is Federer, what he thinks about when he plays. And of course, we don't know that, so we have to imagine. In a way, it's good we didn't meet him for this.
And do you have any idea about whether Roger Federer knows that this play is going to be shown? Does he know about it?
I think now he knows, because we sent mail to his agent, I sent mail to his wife and to his parents. So these last days, I didn't have any answer so far. But I think maybe he heard about it from a friend or of a friend of a friend. I don't know. Maybe he knows it.
Fingers crossed that he'll find out. But I guess on the surface, when you look at Roger Federer as a tennis player, you know, he's a very extremely clean-cut guy. There isn't much scandal around him. So one might think that a whole play around him might be a bit dull. You know, if you look at a character like maybe Lance Armstrong, for example, there's mystery, scandal, a bit of intrigue, deception, lies. That's a very dramatic kind of plot line. So what is it about Roger Federer that you think will be able to sustain audiences for, you know, the length of the play?
Yeah, of course, with Roger Federer, there's no drama. Basically, it's terrible. in a way, it's not for theatre, you are totally right, because there is no drama. But we don't talk about this. We talk about the way he plays and the beauty of the way he plays. And it's strange. We built the show like a very old mood. We sing Roger Federer, and it's basically funny. And in another way, it could be maybe a little bit moving, because of course we even say it in the very beginning of the show, yeah, ladies and gentlemen, there is no drama. There is no drama with this man, of course, or maybe the drama to be kind of lonely, because you are alone in the world, because you are the best, because everything, and when you play, you are alone, basically.
Finally, yeah. It sounds like, you know, we obviously can tell how passionate you are about Roger Federer. Do other people in Switzerland feel as passionately as you about this tennis player?
You know, we met many people who are really crazier as we are. We are really beginners. We meet people and very clever and very responsible people who are really mad. Even we met a lady, for example, who told us, she spoke to his psychiatrist about a patient for Federer, saying it goes too far, it's too crazy, it's too involving in our life. And we are not so crazy, I think. So once again, this is not about real drama.
Well, that was Denis Maillefer talking about his play, which is about Roger Federer. It's monologue time now at this point in today's Midori House. Our news editor, Tom Edwards, has the microphone today. He must have something very weighty and important to say. Just look at the size of the notebook he's been writing in.
Pablo Picasso, Bruce Chatwin, and Ernest Hemingway are amongst the cultural luminaries always cited as fans. And their number has certainly been boosted in recent years as sales have boomed, and the humble notebook has become little short of ubiquitous in briefcases, on boardroom tables, in coffee shops, on desks, trains, planes, everywhere. What am I talking about? Why, the trusty Moleskine notebook, of course. And not so humble after all. The company is launching an IPO in a bid to raise over 300 million euros. It seems it is a good environment for luxury brands in post-crisis Italy after all. But there's another story here, and it's written, no, it's crafted in pen on paper. Come with me as we explore the extraordinary cult of stationery. For Moleskine have mastered the art of marketing themselves as the stuff of legend, despite only existing since 1997, when an Italian publishing house created the brand. Having long since sold on to a private equity firm, one could argue the romance has already evaporated, leaving the notebooks as far from the musings of a wandering Bruce or the instinctive scrawlings of a Pablo as tappings on the latest tablet. And that is maybe the enduring fascination here, as, counterintuitively, the paper notebook has retained and indeed grown in popularity amongst the tech savvy, the antidote, if you like, to the digitisation of our media. The progression of these forms of personal record keeping is of particular interest to champions of paper. In the 1980s, the Filofax was king. It was the embodiment of its age. It was all about personal organisation. It was designed for business. It told the world its owner was, supposedly, going places. Now it's much more about personal expression, insight, dare I say it, a bit of feeling. Writing in a notebook with pen or pencil seems to imbue the very words or pictures with that bit more emotion. Want to know what someone is thinking? Then look at what they are writing. Of course, there's a fair to middling chance that present-day devotees of the Moleskine notebook are merely hoping a little of the stellar authorial lustre of the past might rub off on them. And what of the latest cutting-edge rivals to the written word? There are a range of new apps that promise you'll never lose a note, or indeed a thought, again. I'm unconvinced. The idea that I'll never need to remember anything summons an image of a ghastly dystopian future, memories erased, instincts nullified. And now, as it turns full circle, Moleskine has a new line with specially formatted pages, so it's even easier to back up your paper writings to the cloud. I wonder what Papa Hemingway would have written in his notebook about that. For Monocle, I'm Tom Edwards.
Picasso, Hemingway, Edwards, they all use them. And that's all we have time for today. Thanks to our producer, Dawn Trump, our researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Alexa Firminich, and our studio manager, Toby Hammond. Up next, Monocle's creative director, Richard Spencer Powell. Powell will be dropping in to talk to the Section D team about what we can expect from the style guide in the new edition of Monocle due to hit stands next week. From the retailers and designers they're featuring to the locations of their photo shoots.
It's very exotic. It's a part of the world that you wouldn't traditionally go and do a fashion shoot, and I think that most people don't really know what it looks like, so I think there's a real surprise there.
And then in 3 hours' time, at 2200 hours here in London, Andrew Muller and Phil Harm will be sliding into the studio for the Monocle Daily. Clemency Burton Hill will be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. Luckily, I'm not here. But from me, Andrew Tuck, thank you for listening, and it's time to say goodbye.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.